the afternoon address of Father Charles E. Coughlin from Royal Oak, Michigan.
Ladies and gentlemen, once more may I present Father Coughlin to you. During the first half hour, he will answer the question, where do we stand? For the New Deal or against it? For the reformers or for the reactionaries? After the half hour interval, Father Coughlin will return to the microphone in a second address entitled Social Justice and Democracy. May I assure you that every person in this audience is welcome to a printed copy of these addresses. Reminding you that this presentation is paid for at full commercial rates from the profits derived from Social Justice Magazine and from voluntary contributions made by thousands of persons, it is my privilege to join with you in listening to Father Coughlin in his address entitled, Where Do We Stand? For the Reformers or for the Reactionaries? Father Coughlin.
Ladies and gentlemen, on every side, our friends and critics inquire of us as to where we stand. For the New Deal or against it? For the reformers or for the reactionaries? Let me refresh your memories. Following 1929, it was my privilege to broadcast the encyclical of Leo XIII, which is related to the reconstruction of the social order. The social order needed reconstruction. Wall Street was notorious for its gambling in the commodities of life. Industry was brazenly confiscating the profits of labor. Mass production machinery was multiplying units of wealth and creating idleness. Golden grain was rotting in the fields, and a multitude of children was starving in the cities. Bonuses were paid to manufacturers, and insults were heaped upon World War veterans. Legislation favored the bold and the unconscionable. Restrictions were heaped upon the backs of the masses. Banks were engaged in lending 10 and 20 and 30 times more money than they actually possessed at interest. Homeowners suffered the confiscation of their properties with no redress. Those were the days that were upon us, and these were some of the evils which clamored for national attention. Gladly I helped to pioneer the social revolution which was inevitable. Gladly came 1932 with its presidential election, which at least settled one point. And that point is this: that the majority of American citizens turned their backs once and for all upon those politicians and their masters who had abused the Constitution to support an immoral brand of economy that dealt out debt, that handed us stones instead of bread. At length it was agreed that human rights took precedence over the financial rights, which were established upon the vice of usury. At length, a consolidated front of Catholic and Protestant, Jew, Democrat, Republican, and Socialist, manifested its determination to walk down a new highway, to blaze a new trail, to establish a new social order, and to institute economic liberty for all. Upon the horizon of 1940, there now looms a menacing ghost which has returned from the grave of 1932 to haunt us. His lips are silent, but his lean, uplifted forefinger beckons us backwards whence we emerged. Those who know the past, those who lived through the exploitation of the 20s, Those who remember the wicked trickery of the warmongers whose greed and deceit catapulted us into the world war, they scorn that invitation. And eventually they will spurn it, even though sanctimonious words and prayers are raised in condemnation of the radicalism which seeks their patronage at the present moment. Certainly, they argue, certainly the future can be no worse than the past. My friends, there is no turning back, to be sure. America's destiny lies forward. There is no repentance for having abandoned the old order. All that is left is hope and courage to fashion a new order upon whose unfurled banner there is enscrolled the legend "For God and Country." If from this microphone there originated criticism of the leaders who instituted the national revolt initiated in 1932, it was honest criticism, because their policies temporized with the evils of the past, with its overburdening taxation and its financial slavery. Then as now, the followers of social justice inveigh against any program which disparages the working men and the farmers by protecting the existence of tax-exempt bonds in favor of the privileged few. Then as now, we protest against the private issuance and control of money which halts production and denies consumption in a land of plenty. Then as now, we militate against the adoption of communistic policies which relentlessly aim at nationalizing private industry, private farms, and private homes. Then as now, we take our stand against usury in finance, usury in markets, usury in industry, and usury in politics. A usury which siphons the lifeblood from the arteries of our nation. Then as now, we plead for the inauguration of the principle of production for use at a profit for all, and the abolition of the heresy of production at a profit for the controllers of wealth. Then as now, we support the program of social justice for all. Social justice not only for the bankers and the industrialists, but social justice for the laborer, the farmer, the professional man, the homeowner, the housewife, the youth, and the millions of little children who are unnecessarily denied a participation in the wealth of this nation, because a group of men are more interested in worshipping a gold hoard in Kentucky and the debt bonds in their vaults than they are in respecting the image of Jesus Christ stamped upon the souls of our fellow citizens. To turn backwards? Never. To go forward? Most certainly. Recently, it was well advertised that our banks are bulging with money, that there are no available borrowers in industry. That is true. But what kind of money is it? It is not money predicated against the wealth of the nation. It is not money which you people deposited in these banks. It is not money which you have earned by the sweat of your brow. In truth, it is debt money, credit money. It represents the bills you owe for the billions of dollars expended on relief. It represents the billions of dollars which were blown into shell holes and shattered bodies in France. It represents the bonds which, through the process of taxation, you who are working for less than living wages And you who are following your plows at a loss are expected to redeem. It is usurious money that's bulging in our banks. So usurious that from every $3 which the ordinary laborer earns, $1 and more must be set aside to placate the coupon shippers and the nobility of wealth whose minions stand guard at Fort Knox, Kentucky, gloating over the gold that lies idle to keep company with idle men. And meanwhile, where is the purchasing power amongst the masses to buy the products of factories and thieves? God knows, and so do you, that the most the majority of our citizens can accomplish with their slender payrolls is to keep body and soul together under a humble roof with no thought of purchasing the shiny motor cars, the magnificent refrigerators, the splendid clothing and furniture which our factories are able to produce and do not produce. Because you, the American laborer and farmer, are shackled in the temple of Mammon. Be convinced of this, my friends. When the United States of America was lured into the World War through the agency of lying tongues and pens, it was not difficult to raise sufficient money within the confines of our shores to procure destruction. Oh, billions of dollars of bonds for destructive purposes. Billions of dollars of bonds to save the British Empire and the French Republic. Billions of dollars of bonds which we Americans are struggling to redeem, even though it costs us the maintenance of an army of 12 million unemployed, of 22 million doasters, of 60 million fellow citizens who are forced to live beneath our one-time glorious standard of existence. Are you aware that when our soldiers landed on French soil in 1917, the French government levied a duty on every can of beans, on every pound of food, on every ton of war supplies that we shipped into France to save the honor of the fleur-de-lis? Are you aware that the French government, now turned dictator, endeavored to impose a duty on the American war supplies that had not been used as our ships were prepared to bring them home? Are you aware that both France and Great Britain charged us an average of $160 for every American soldier which their ships carried from the United States to Europe and to death? Are you aware that the French government imposed a fine upon you American people for the property destroyed by our soldiers in France through the explosion of American shells exploded to save France? Are you aware that our military forces dredged harbors, built docks, erected thousands of miles of telephone and telegraph wires, all of which have remained as gifts to France? And finally, are you aware that it is estimated that by the time all our war obligations are met, we will have made a total investment of not less than $150 billion for non-productive purposes. And this does not include the bloodshed, the heartaches, the blasted homes, the broken bodies of the young men whom we will remember next Sunday and over whose white crosses we will shed our tears. $150 billion for destruction. $150 billion to make the world safe for democracy. To end all wars. To generate a Lenin and a Stalin, a Hitler and a Belakoon, an atheism and a massacre of 20 million Christians. Twice as many as suffered death during the actual hostilities of the World War. And yet we Americans, who are lavish with our expenditures for destruction, are niggardly with our dollars for construction, simply because money is held and controlled in the hands of a few, to the detriment of the masses in America. What would $150 billion accomplish if money, the receipt for wealth, not the receipt for debt? What would $150 billion accomplish if money were coined and regulated by the Congress of the United States for productive purposes? I will tell you. It would build nearly 6 million miles of paved roads, which is approximately 9 times the mileage of all surface roads in America. It would construct 38,250,000 six-room houses, enough to house with a new home every family in this nation of ours. It would erect 48 hospitals costing $1 million each in every one of the 3,073 counties of these United States. It would open up every factory, give jobs to more than 60 million men, and pay unemployment insurance premiums on all business and industry for more than 300 years to come. Turn backwards? Never. Forward we must march, even though we continue to be critical of those with whom together we stand in opposition to the old order of usury. Eventually, financial rights must surrender to human rights. Eventually, private ownership must be multiplied and confiscation of homes and farms and jobs and life must be. Under our Constitution and within the scope of the gospel of Christ, these things can be accomplished and shall be accomplished. Class must cease antagonizing class, and particularly the financial class must cease attacking the laboring and agricultural classes with the sword of their usury. Recognize that our problems have been the problems of other nations. In little Portugal, that was both backward and bankrupt, there arose within the last decade a mighty leader by the name of Salazar, who rejuvenated his nation not by abandoning democracy and Christianity, but by flinging his force together with those of his followers against the usury which bowed down his native land. He said, "We have distorted the idea of wealth in Portugal. We have divorced it from its object, which is to serve worthily the life of man. We have put it into a separate category, apart from the interests of the community and apart from moral concepts. And we have imagined that the destiny of individuals, of states, and of nations is to accumulate goods without regard for social utility, without regard for justice in their acquisition or their use. And more than that," said he, "we have distorted the idea of labor, and we've forgotten the personality of the laborer, his dignity as a human being. We've thought only of his value as a producing machine. We've measured and weighed his productive power, and we've not so much as remembered that he's a member of a family. Yes, we've gone further. We've dispersed the home, called forth the woman and the child as factors and production. In fact, we've destroyed the family." Thus spoke Salazar,
who repulse the leaders and believers of usury and misery. The same Salazar who wrought in little Portugal the miracle of plenty amidst poverty. A challenge to us to bring forth plenty in the midst of plenty. What Portugal has accomplished, America can accomplish, particularly since we have plenty available. If in former years we could regiment the credit of this nation to fight a war of destruction, we are still capable of harnessing the wealth of America to fight a war for the preservation of our Constitution and of our Christianity and of our people who have been exploited through the worst vice of the centuries, the vice of usury. A new deal, therefore, that is in harmony with the principles of the Founding Fathers and the principles of Christ. That is what the followers of social justice have supported in the past and will continue to support in the future, independent of politicians and independent of their money masters. Only to those who face the past, only to those who are filled with reactionaryism, does it seem impossible to institute an annual living wage for every laborer who is able and willing to work, and production at a profit for the farmer. Therein, my friends, I believe I have expressed the policies of social justice. Thereby, I have answered the question of our correspondent. We stand not with the reactionaries, but with the reformers. For the objectives and the principles which I have incorporated in this address, and which will be supplemented in the following address, stands Social Justice Magazine. It militates for the poor and the oppressed. It is the spokesman for the property holder, the laborer, and the farmer. It unfurls the flag of Christianity and of Americanism. To no group of politicians, to no political party, and to no cause other than the causes which I have described, are the editorial policies of this news weekly dedicated. As election time approaches, as the problems which concern the voters of the United States are discussed more avidly, Social Justice Magazine asks, without any apology, that it find entrance in your home, in your office, and in your factory. To facilitate the circulation of social justice even during these summer months, I am asking for those who believe in the principles which I have just expressed. I am asking 10,000 of you to volunteer to become distributors of Social Justice Magazine at a profit for yourself. And I am inviting those of you who live in distant parts, perchance, where distributors are not available, to permit me to send social justice to your homes every week with this pledge that to the best of my ability, its pages will not be found supporting politicians, but rather principles. Principles which are not colored by the advertising dollar. Principles which are not subject to the whim and control of the financialist. Principles which do not genuflect before the chancelleries of foreign governments. Principles which are American and Christian, and which will continue to be so as long as free speech and free press are protected in this nation. My friends, God bless all those men and women who have been walking shoulder to shoulder to destroy the old order of exploitation, to destroy the old policies that bred war, to destroy the old financial principles that begot poverty. God bless every one of us. And in this struggle, therefore, for reform, in order to avoid revolution, we ask you to consider what is wrong economically with America. We are not lacking fields. We are not lacking factories. We are not lacking skilled working men. We are not lacking skilled executives. Our markets have the greatest demand for the product of the field and factory that ever existed in any nation since the beginning of time. And all that stops the wheels of the factories from moving, all that stops the men and women living throughout our country from purchasing the necessities and conveniences of life is that man-made thing called money. No purchasing power. Because, contrary to our Constitution, the Constitution of the United States, money is not regulated by Congress as it should be. Money is predicated against the billions of debts which you, the slaves of economy, are expected to bear and burden for generations to come. When will you recognize this? When will you unfurl the banner of economic liberty under Jesus Christ? Write to me directly. If you will volunteer to become a distributor of Social Justice Magazine at a profit for yourself, or if you care to become a subscriber of the fastest growing weekly magazine in the United States, be assured that all profits derived from this publication will help maintain the permanence of this broadcast.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is to be hoped that literally many thousands in this audience will heed the appeal made by Father Coghlan at the close of the address to which you have just listened. Conscious that this is your broadcast, that your spokesman upholds Christianity and Americanism, once more may I remind you to write to Father Coghlan this week for a copy of the address which you have heard, and of the one which follows immediately on most stations associated with this network.
Father Coghlan's address to tell you that you are listening to WHBI, Hoyt Brothers Incorporated, Newark, New Jersey, on your dial at 1250 kilocycles.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is again my privilege to present to you Father Coughlin in his address, Social Justice and Democracy. A copy of the speech which the pastor of the Shrine of the Little Flower is about to deliver is yours for the asking. Write directly to him this week. And now once again, Father Coughlin.
My friends, the Empire Nation rejoices in that the war issue has waned considerably during the past week. This is a benediction because it permits us to engage our attention upon national affairs with the hope of solving our difficulties in a manner harmonious with the best American and Christian tradition. I ask your indulgence, therefore, while I restate some principles of social justice and clarify certain misapprehensions which have gained credence. From the beginning of these broadcasts, nearly 12 years ago, it was and still is my objective to make some contribution towards abolishing unnecessary want in the midst of plenty. Confessedly, I attributed the so-called depression not to any act implemented by Almighty God, but to certain practiced policies of man. These policies, to my mind, were responsible for our individual, our social, and our national ills. As individuals, too many of us lost sight of the truth that we are children of God, created by him and for him. As individuals, too many of us adopted a material concept of life, believing that happiness was measured by the yardstick of this world's wealth, social prominence, and power. Unfortunately, religion was regarded by some as an elective diversion, by others as an impediment to progress, and an impractical theory of life. To seek first God and his justice, so that all things else could be added unto us, became an abandoned principle. As a result, pulpits were desecrated, churches were empty, homes were naturalized, and great portions of our population relapsed into a modified form of paganism. For Christ, in whom we live and move and have our being, there was substituted the new idol of self. And for Christ's basic doctrine of charity or love, there was substituted the doctrine of individualism. One of the basic social doctrines predicated by Christ taught us that whatsoever we do to the least of his little ones, we do unto him. Formerly, that truth had been the guideline of our personal and social relations. In fact, it was the bond which held together all the units of society, employers and employees, laborers and farmers, merchants and miners, masters and servants. But in recent years, the blight of individualism began to affect the social relations of one class towards another. I mean the more powerful classes began to exploit the less powerful. Employers began to exploit laborers. Lenders began to exploit borrowers. Politicians began to exploit taxpayers. The principle of personal and class individualism gradually superseded the principle of class cooperation, even in nations which were characterized as Christian, and thus there departed from our midst in a great degree the principle of God's charity. Christianity teaches that it is very difficult for a man to save his immortal soul when he is unjustly denied the goods of this world. In the 19th century, so-called civilization made rapid advances through the agency of mechanical machinery, through the inventions of Fulton and his steam engine, of Arkwright and his looms, of Edison and his dynamo. The problem of producing sufficient food, shelter, clothing, and the multiple conveniences which we require was solved. But the newly adopted principle of individualism saw to it that, generally speaking, the industrialists who owned the power-driven machine accumulated the wealth of the nation, while the laborers who worked in the factories amassed nothing more than poverty. Moreover, those who owned and controlled money and credit, forgetful of the Christian doctrine of stewardship, used their questionable prerogative of money control not to multiply goods for the general welfare and use of all classes, but to amass wealth for themselves. In too many instances, the financial class of society not only gained control over production, but also of legislation, and insisted upon entire parliaments and congresses adopting the policy that goods should be produced only when a profit accrued to the owners of machinery and to the controllers of money. Eventually, want in the midst of plenty characterized the national lives of the British Empire, Germany, France, the United States, and practically every country where this abuse of capitalism, of rugged, ragged individualism, predominated. That is why cargoes of coffee were thrown into the sea by the Brazilian government. That is why cotton was plowed under, corn was burned, and cattle were destroyed by the American government. Millions of citizens suffering from a lack of life's necessities were penalized to protect the false principles of individualistic capitalism and its theories of finance, while social injustice and class domination reigned supreme. Social justice resents the practices identified with class domination, of class exploitation, of financial control through usury. Social justice upholds the principle of class cooperation, sincerely believing that whatsoever we do to the least of God's little ones, we do unto him, and positively upholding the Christian teaching of stewardship, which means that the Creator is the absolute owner of all the goods of this world, and that we, his creatures, are nothing more than his agents. The followers of social justice protest against the continuance of any man-made economy which is opposed to these doctrines. It protests against the principle of capitalism which is cited in these words, production for profit, and it upholds the principle of production for use at a profit for all. Therefore, we declare that every laboring man should have an adequate share in the goods of this nation through the agency of a just living annual wage. That every farmer should be guaranteed production at a profit. That every industrialist should receive reasonable gain. That it is the business of government not to confiscate property, but to regulate money, not to tax initiative out of existence, but to promote the desire for private propertyship, not to protect a financial policy which keeps factories closed and millions unemployed. It is the duty of government to institute laws which will prevent class from exploiting class, and which enables production to equal the demand of consumption. Specifically, during the past 12 years, these and other principles have been expounded.
while I have opposed the flagrant abuses of capitalism, which succeeded in concentrating wealth and multiplying poverty, I have equally opposed the errors of communism. For to my mind, communism is the left wing and modern capitalism is the right wing of the same bird of prey. It is my contention that the abuses of capitalism inevitably will stir class against class, terminating in an unnecessary revolution. Likewise, I believe that communism, with its glorification of the proletariat, its abomination of private property holders, its detestation of religion and Christianity, will produce social, economic, and spiritual chaos. The above statements, I admit, are definitely abstract. In these days when a multitude of Americans are anxious to stem the rising tide of red communism, it might be well for them to recollect that the scientific approach to their task lies in the direction of removing the causes which generate communism. The coal miners who returned to work last week will not be satisfied for long unless they are paid an annual living wage. The laborers in the motor, the textile, the steel, and other industries are idle by the millions. Soon their patience will reach the breaking point, and soon the national revenue will be unable to deal out dole for their pacification. The cotton farmers of the South are weary of seeing their fields idle because they know that millions upon millions of Americans, wealthy financially circumstanced, are anxious to purchase the finished product of the loom. It is true that temporary relief is being extended by the federal government to all these unfortunates. But it is likewise true that this federal relief cannot endure without bankruptcy for the entire nation if we persist in protecting the present system of financial usury. To remove the causes which generate these abuses is the most practical step towards removing communism from our midst. Therefore, it should be the concern of the industrialists and the property holders, as much as it is the concern of the laborers and the farmers. For what good are the factories? What good are your farms and homes if idleness is multiplied and if consumption of goods is not made possible by all? It should be the concern of every American who wishes to avoid an inevitable overthrow of our Constitution and its republican institutions, equally as much as it should be the concern of every Christian and religionist to abolish once and for all the present economy that means want in the midst of plenty. For the past several years, while opposing communism, I have been advocating reforms in harmony with social justice. What gain has resulted therefrom? Truthfully, I cannot gauge it. Only this do I know. For specifying the abuses of capitalism, I have been called a radical. For inviting religious Jews and Gentiles to join not only in condemning Nazism, but also communism, I have been labeled an anti-Semite. For questioning the efficiency of certain government officials, I am described as a fascist. for building a church costing well more than $1 million during the height of our depression in order to give employment to the Catholics and Protestants and Jews living in my neighborhood, I have been described as unfair to labor. Although the records show that every working man and artisan engaged in that task was paid wages 10% higher, 10% higher than those stipulated in Michigan by the American Federation of Labor. For being interested in the publication of Social Justice magazine, I have been branded as an opponent to unionism, although this magazine is printed in the largest union shop in the world. For having been critical of Mr. John L. Lewis and his CIO, I have been termed a reactionary, although I was the first to point out that the CIO was operating without benefit of a constitution and without benefit of an election of officers. If we must have labor unions in these United States, let us have democratic labor unions. Chiefly was I critical of this organization because in many instances it entrusted its destinies to well-known communists, and in others attempted to establish a political party in the interests of the labor class only, not pretending them to be in the interest of the millions of Americans who earn their livelihood outside the ranks of labor. All these criticisms are immaterial, for today as of yesterday, it will be my objective to make whatsoever contributions I can for the betterment of the exploited masses of America. Exploited not only by industrialists and financialists, but too often by leaders who unintentionally, I grant, have been handing stones to the farmers and laborers of America, people who are crying their bread. My friends, our condition in America is desperate. But our hopes for reform have not been dissipated. Why is it that we have not solved the problem of distributing wealth? Let us begin at the beginning with the appreciation of the principle that we must work for each other, not against each other. That we must cooperate, class with class, labor with capital. That we must not permit any one class to sink its iron heel of usury into our bodies. Long enough have we entertained the idea that labor is only a producing machine to grind out profits for the industrialists. My friends, we must abandon that idea. We must consider that the laboring man is just as good an American, just as fine a Christian as any of us, that he must be treated as you would treat Jesus Christ. Meanwhile, under the mantle of democracy, we continue to cloak the serpents of economic slavery. Oh, yes, economic slavery is here, although we talk about democracy. It's been here for many years. It's here today. You have no money with which to buy the necessities of life, many of you. You have no wherewithal to supply your wife and children with the conveniences they need. You are an economic, you are a financial slave. Under democracy, all this democracy that cloaks itself. My, it's a serpent whose fangs are poisoning our homes, our churches, our schools, our public institutions,
and is making ready a revolution for America. Or do not misunderstand me. I am not against democracy. I am against this serpent that cloaks itself under the name of democracy. I want democracy not only in politics, but also in economics. For all of us. In the chaos which surrounds us, see the fruits of the so-called democracy which we are in. 12 million unemployed, 22 million doldsters, 60 million tax-oppressed citizens, barren fields, idle factories, confiscated homes, class bitterness, political hatreds, racial animosities, and $55 billion of tax-exempt bonds, together with $15 billion of buried gold. I ask you, are these part and parcel of that magic word, democracy, with which most of us identify the benedictions of liberty? When I ask you again, can we stand together for economic liberty, for a just living annual wage for all, for production at a profit for the farmers, for the definition that money is not wealth, but is only the receipt for wealth? Many years ago, precisely in 1901, when these questions were discussed by Leo XIII in his encyclical entitled Christian Democracy, he said, what social democracy is and what Christian democracy ought to be, assuredly no one can doubt. Social democracy, with due consideration to the greater or less intemperance of its utterance, is carried to such an excess by many as to maintain that there's really nothing existing above the natural order of things, that the acquirement and enjoyment of corporal and external goods constitutes all man's happiness. Social democracy aims at putting all government in the hands of the people, reducing all ranks to the same level, abolishing all distinctions of class, and finally introducing community of goods. Hence, the right of ownership is to be abrogated. And whatever property a man possesses, or whatever means of livelihood he has, is to be common to all. This great labor leader and religious leader also says, as against this, Christian democracy, by the fact that it is Christian, is built, and necessarily so, on the basic principles of divine faith, and provides for the betterment of the masses, with the ulterior object of availing itself of the occasion to fashion their minds for things that are everlasting. Hence, for Christian democracy, justice is sacred. It must maintain that the right of acquiring and possessing property cannot be impugned. It must safeguard the various distinctions and degrees which are indispensable in every well-ordered commonwealth. It must endeavor to preserve in every human society the form and the character which God ever impresses on it. It is clear, continues this pontiff, that there is nothing in common between social and Christian democracy. They differ from each other as much as the sect of socialism differs from the profession of Christianity. My fellow Americans, democracy, which is naturalistic and which puts God out of the picture of our lives, which is divorced from the principles of Christ, which is based on the principles of nationalism to determine right from wrong, justice from injustice, that kind of democracy which refuses to be limited in establishing policy, in writing laws, in proposing reforms, and in all its activities by the gospels and traditions of Jesus Christ. That kind of democracy that does not regard our fellow man almost as another Christ. That leads not to liberty, but to the dissolution of all wealth, both spiritual, political, and material. Therefore, I call upon you, certainly to preserve what we have of Christian democracy. Preserve the political liberties which we have won. Preserve the liberty of conscience which is ours. And strive and struggle under Christ and his principles to obtain economic liberty which has been denied us even by those who talk loudest of democracy. These thoughts which I have expressed are not acceptable, perchance, to the atheistic radicals whose only God is the state and whose only fountainhead of religion is the dust kapital of Karl Marx. Nor, perchance, will this address be acceptable to the selfish politician who is inclined today as of yesterday to temporize with the basic evils which beset us, lest he offends the privileged princes of money control for whom he operates. The same ones who own the debt of this nation and for whom by law under democracy you and I and every taxpayer, every laborer, every farmer are constrained to sacrifice our possessions, to contribute our labor as we serve before the altar of Mammon. There can be no democracy and Mammon worship. Democracy can exist only under Jesus Christ. My friend, I invite you to write today or tomorrow for a copy of the address which I have just delivered. It is yours for the asking. And I also invite you to participate in reading Social Justice magazine. Perhaps you can help us in its distribution. God bless every one of you.
Ladies and gentlemen, as you realize, this program is paid for at full commercial rates. It is supported partly by the profits derived from the sale of Social Justice magazine and partly by free will offerings, which thousands of persons in this audience feel inclined to contribute towards the maintenance of this presentation. May I remind you again to write to Father Coughlin this week for your copy of the two addresses which he delivered today. Sunday afternoon, when Father Coughlin will be with you again, this is your announcer, Franklin Mitchell, bidding you good afternoon.
Ladies and gentlemen, we've presented the regular Sunday afternoon address of Father Charles D. Coughlin from Royal Oak, Michigan. The thoughts and opinions contained in this address were entirely those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect the policies of this station. Father Coughlin's program has been a presentation on your dial, at 1,250 kilocycles.
Ladies, stop and...